How France Helped Us Win the American Revolution. Today is the 4th of July. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The U.S. has had its differences with France, but Independence Day is a good time to remember America's first ally and its revolutionary general.
If we forget it today, it was certainly not forgotten in the 19th century. Lafayette was remembered, venerated, almost on par with George Washington as his sort of adopted son.
Also today, leaving home for a new life in the U.S.
The night before I was leaving for the U.S., I couldn't even sleep. I was so excited about it.
And living through those first moments in a new country.
When we arrived in Los Angeles, all I remember was looking at my mother's face for a sense of understanding what was going on.
Plus, why one scholar thinks a period in the Declaration of Independence should really be a comma.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills, in for Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's July 4th, a holiday where we celebrate independence and the creation of a democratic nation. Democratic and stable are adjectives the U.S. hoped would describe Iraq after the U.S. invasion there. And many Iraqis imagined that after all they went through, they'd end up with a peaceful nation. Right now, though, that seems very far off. The militant Sunni group ISIS, or the Islamic State, as it now wants to be known, has been steamrolling across large parts of Iraq and killing people in its path. Today, we turn to David Patel to help us reflect on what's happening there. He's a Middle East scholar at Brandeis University, and he spent a lot of time living and studying in Iraq. He told me that for someone like him, what's been happening there comes as little surprise.
I think a lot of Americans had tuned out of what was happening in Iraq for the past couple of years. I think the Arab Spring and events elsewhere in the Middle East had taken over, in general, burnout of what was happening. But those of us who are still focused on Iraq, things have been getting very bad for a long time now. Since 2009, 2010, there's been a steady decline in security in many parts of Iraq, and violence was off the charts for the past year. So this attention is now back on Iraq because of ISIS, but things have been very bad there for quite some time now.
Now, we have this group ISIS, or the Islamic State. They're kind of making their way, pushing their way south in a very violent, brutal way. They're edging toward Baghdad. They're near one of cities, Samarra, that has sacred sites. And I know these Shia sacred sites are something you've written a lot about. Tell us about these sacred sites and why they're so important.
Well, there's four major ones for Shias in Iraq. The two major ones are south of Baghdad in the Shia heartland, Najaf and Karbala. And those are really the central shrines and contain the graves of the two most important figures in post-Muhammad Shia history. The one that's most threatened right now, though, is Samarra, which is up north. It's between Tikrit and Baghdad. And so it's really on the front lines of this ISIS-Iraqi government confrontation. And so one way of thinking about ISIS targeting the shrines is actually taking over territory that includes the shrines. Samarra is right in there, is right in that category now. The other way of being a target are attempts by ISIS to blow up the shrine or attack the shrine in order to start a sectarian war, which is their goal. They've said that's their goal. Their predecessor organizations in Iraq made that their goal and achieved it back in February 2006 when they attacked that shrine in Samarra in February of that year. So one is them trying to take over territory that happens to include those shrines. The second is actually targeting those shrines in order to provoke retaliation on Sunnis within the country.
Now, let's go to Samarra. Take us there. If we went to Samarra today to this shrine, what would we see and who would be there?
Well, I imagine what you'd see would be tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers and volunteers, probably many of them Shias from outside Iraq as well, guarding the shrine and trying to prevent ISIS.
And what is
ISIS.
The shrine? What would we see?
So you'd see a giant gold dome over a tomb. And so in Samarra, it's called the Askariya Shrine, and it contains the graves of two of the 12 imams, the 10th and 11th imams. And next to it is also a place where the 12th imam, the Mahdi, the Messiah, went into occultation, where he removed himself from earth. He's not dead. So it's not his grave. And so this is really core for Shia belief. This is where the Mahdi left earth. And everything in Shia politics today is about how you govern the world in the absence of this just ruler, the Mahdi, right? The Iranian government is based on the idea that the cleric should be running thing until he returns. This site is inextricably linked to the Mahdi and to those two of those 12 other imams.
Okay, take us further south then to Najaf and Karbala. What are the shrines there and what do pilgrims do when they go?
Oh, it's an amazing experience. So those shrines in Najaf and Karbala, where the most venerated imams are buried, those were the commemorations of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, who died in 680. It's really, that moment is really central for what it means to be a Shia. Let me take you to Karbala. The two enormous shrines, about a football-sized field each, with a large open space between them. And the shrines have a huge gold dome over a very elaborate sarcophagus with gold plating, silver plating all around it. And people will be running back and forth, large pilgrimages groups. You'll hear people speaking Arabic, but different Arabic accents, some Lebanese, some Iraqi accents, some Bahraini accents. You'll see Iranians there speaking Farsi. There'll be Indian pilgrims there. There'll be pilgrims from Detroit, Michigan, from Nigeria visiting these shrines. And when you go into the building themselves, the emotion that people have is just simply overwhelming.
And is it men and women or just men?
Men and women both, but they'll be segregated in separate areas. And so I've been in the areas with the men. And what you really are overcome by is the grief and the empathetic experience of solidarity that these pilgrims have with the imam's pain. And these are grown men who've fought in a number of wars, who've worked their whole lives, working class and rich side by side, wailing hysterically oftentimes.
Really?
Absolutely.
Are there certain kind of smells and feel that you feel when you go to these shrines, or incense?
Incense, certainly. But since 2003, the number of people has just been overwhelming. These cities have been booming. This is, aside from Kurdistan, this is probably the area that has grown and developed the most.
This is Najaf and Karbala.
Najaf and Karbala.
Give me a sense of if ISIS or Islamic State, if they attacked one of these shrines, say in Najaf or Karbala, I mean, is it conceivable that that could happen?
Well, in February 2006, the way they were able to blow up a large part of the shrine in Samarra were insurgents, Al-Qaeda in Iraq at the time. At the time, they called themselves Al-Qaeda in the Land of the Two Rivers, the predecessor of ISIS. They snuck some guys in dressed in Iraqi military uniforms, and they got in there, tied up the Iraqi police and soldiers guarding the shrine and planted the bombs. So they were able to infiltrate it. And I think the fear is with so many volunteers coming, with so many people, so many militias, and so many clerics and political organizations around Iraq sending militias and volunteers there to quote-unquote defend the shrine, the fear is that ISIS will be able to sneak in some suicide bombers or some people with bombs posing as defenders of the shrine. And so I think that among Shia groups that are defending the shrines now, that's the real concern.
As Iraq moves forward, here we are on July 4th, celebrating the independence of a nation, and then we kind of have some clear boundaries of what that nation is. If you could imagine a future Iraq that might be celebrating its own independence or its own new future, what do those borders look like?
I think it's hard to have a conversation about what the future borders of Iraq will look like without looking at the larger regional picture. This conflict that's going on, and I say this conflict because now the conflicts in Syria and Iraq have merged, I think this is going to go on for at least another decade. And so I think we need to ask this question again in a decade. If Syria will still have the same borders it has, if Iraq will still have the same borders that it has, if what Kurdistan looks like, the entire political order in the Middle East in many ways is being challenged by what's going on right now.
David, I know you spent a lot of time in Iraq living there and studying there. Who in Iraq are you thinking about?
Today in particular, I'm thinking about a friend, Ghufran Ahmed. He's probably about 39, 40 years old now. I don't remember exactly when his birthday was. He lived in Mosul, doesn't come from a wealthy family, but he was able to come to the United States, get a master's in archaeology from Stony Brook, and he went back and was teaching at Mosul University after 2009, teaching prehistory. He's Iraq's first prehistorian, and he had to flee Mosul when ISIS took over. He, his wife, and his two daughters are now in Iraqi Kurdistan. He's stuck there. He doesn't know anyone there. He doesn't have any connections, and he can't return home. If he does, he'll be killed almost immediately. So I'm thinking an awful lot about Ghufran today, not just about where he is today, but what the next decade of his life is going to look like and his daughters' lives.
That's David Patel, a research fellow at the Crown Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Brandeis University. Another place where the U.S. has devoted considerable energy is Israel and the Palestinian territories. Things aren't going very well there either at the moment. Today, angry crowds gathered for the funeral of a 16-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Abu Khadir. Palestinians say he was killed in revenge for the murder of three Israeli teenagers who'd been hitchhiking in the West Bank. The Israeli government is hunting for the killers of those three boys, and it blames Hamas. Hamas officials have denied involvement, but at the same time, they've praised the killers. That may say something about Hamas's position now, caught between maintaining its reputation as a resistance force and not stirring up trouble with Israel. Daniela Cheslow reports from Hebron.
Israel has named two murder suspects. One is Marwan Kawasme. His extended family is one of Hebron's largest and has long had ties to Hamas. Israel has killed nine Kawasmes for militant activity. The Israeli army says Marwan Kawasme, 29, is part of this tradition. He's been jailed five times, and they say he's admitted to being a member of Hamas and using the caves around Hebron for militant training. On Monday, the Israeli army blew up Marwan's home, part of a four-apartment complex in Hebron. His sister, Rawan, walked through the wreckage with me this week.
There was a fire here, and it went on for a long time. They refused to remove all the gas canisters, and so everything exploded.
The fire destroyed the upstairs apartments of Marwan's brothers, Bilal and Sharif. The ceilings were held up by rusted metal pipes, which Rawan says the Hebron municipality brought over this week. The Kawasmes are furious that 16 people in their family are now homeless. But they also believe it's impossible that Marwan was involved in the murder of the three Israelis. His sister, Rawan, says there's no proof. And he wouldn't do it.
Marwan got married. He has a wife. His wife is pregnant. It's impossible that he would do this now. Marwan is not a member of Hamas.
I ask about the green Hamas flag flying on the roof.
We're not
Hamas. Some young lads came and put the flags on our house, and we don't know it. We don't know why they did that.
Another relative, Mohammed Kawasme.
In Hebron, people believe that the kidnapping has not taken place. This is all political maneuvering on the part of the Israelis.
The Israeli army says it hasn't released all the evidence that points conclusively to Kawasme. Even so, they say, why else would he and his fellow murder suspect, Amr Abu Aisha, have disappeared since the kidnapping? Israeli officials have said, regardless of who murdered the teens, they hold the Islamic militant group Hamas responsible. And Hamas will pay for the crime. Since the kidnapping, Israel has arrested hundreds of Hamas members, including 12 legislators. But Hebron University political scientist Assad El-Awewi says it's not so far-fetched that Hamas had no knowledge of the attack.
What could have happened is that a group is creating mutiny against Hamas, a group that is splitting from Hamas and that is cooperating with groups that are more extreme.
El-Awewi says the kidnapping is bad for Hamas. The group was bouncing back after years of being ostracized and underfunded and recently ended a 7-year rift with its rival faction, Fatah. And, El-Awewi says, Hamas was actually looking forward to a period of calm to rebuild itself. But now, Hamas is in a bind. It doesn't want to claim responsibility for murders it didn't carry out. But the leadership can't condemn the killings either.
If Hamas were to condemn this act, it would lose its popular support. Hamas basically is a resistance movement and always moves in that direction. Hence, it cannot condemn.
Thousands of demonstrators converged on a cemetery in East Jerusalem today to bury 16-year-old Mohammed Abu Khadir. He was allegedly kidnapped and murdered by Jewish Israelis in retaliation for the three slain Jewish teens. Hamas has fired dozens of rockets from Gaza over the past week, and Israel has responded with punishing airstrikes. Both sides have vowed revenge, although they also pledge to uphold a ceasefire as long as the other side does. For The World, I'm Daniela Cheslow, Hebron, the West Bank.
This is PRI. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Many of you might be out barbecuing today for the 4th, a very American tradition for one and all on a hot summer day, and the subject of a short film about a young Sikh couple who have just moved to the U.S.
Happy July 4th, my dear American. Get ready. Barbecue shopping.
Without giving too much away, that shopping trip ends with the couple facing the ignorance of the community they've moved into. Arpita Kumar directed the short film, My Dear Americans. It's part of the PBS Online Film Festival.
I thought it would be interesting to take a tradition, an American tradition, but present it from the point of view of an outsider. So I selected 4th of July because it's the most American and the most patriotic. And at the same time, a year ago, actually, there was this horrible incident in Wisconsin where a white supremacist barged into a Sikh Gurudwara, which is a Sikh place of worship, and opened fire largely because he associated the Sikhs with Osama bin Laden. And for me, it was really shocking because it was a decade, more than a decade after 9/11, and there was still such ignorance about the Sikh community. And what I realized was that you can't do much about the ignorance of others, but what you could do is change your reaction to that ignorance. And so that's what prompted the narrative and the actions of the wife, Tejpreet, in the short film.
Yeah, I want to talk about the film and how you portrayed the characters. The husband in the film, in this Sikh couple, he's very gung-ho about moving to the U.S. and ready to take on the 4th of July, while the wife is really struggling with her new country. Explain how you see these two different versions of the immigrant experience.
Well, I mean, when I moved here, and I moved here 11 years ago, and I was more aligned with the husband, I was really enthusiastic. And the night before I was leaving for the U.S., I couldn't even sleep. I was so excited about it. But over the years, I mean, the enthusiasm hasn't tapered that much, but definitely I've gained more gravity and have sort of a more complex understanding of national identity and, you know, the concept of home and immigration. When I was writing it, I realized that moving here, I was exhilarated, but there were also moments when I was overwhelmed and there were moments I would retreat inward. So I tried to sort of bring these characters out from those two reactions that I would have, where one, I was absolutely overjoyed, and then there were moments where I was shocked and nothing made sense and I would retreat inwards and just observe, you know, the world around me. So I tried to kind of build these characters out of those two sort of reactions.
And of course, one point that doesn't seem to make sense to, I think, the couple in the film or to the wife in the film is the couple in the film, they go to Costco to buy food for a big 4th of July barbecue.
Yeah.
And your depiction of Costco was really interesting. And I understand this was based on a personal experience from when you moved to the States from India for college.
Yeah, I remember it was my second day and they took us to Target. They didn't even take us to Costco. And I'm from a really small part of India, so I had not been to like such a huge supermarket. The fluorescent lights and the variety and the choices, and then just and all the other students, many of them are from Western Europe or like East Asia where they had been exposed to, you know, markets like this. I didn't even know how to like navigate it. And like it was really overwhelming. And that was like, I think, the first terrifying moment of my life. I was like, where am I and how do you do this? But I try to draw from that. I had always heard about the mythical Costco, you know, so I was like, let's go check Costco out.
Well, you know, what struck me about the scene in Costco was that many of the other customers in there were also immigrants.
Yes, that's great. Because what happened was that we couldn't finish in time. So they let us shoot as they were opening the store on Sunday morning. And so it's like they open the gates and all these people come rushing in. And I noticed like 50% of them were immigrants. So many people were from different parts of the world rushing to Costco.
Now, I know that you've shown the film at several festivals. It's now online on PBS. How have people reacted?
A lot of people who have moved to the country, you know, they come and share with me their experiences, which has been beautiful, you know, to hear the different points of view. And then women love the character of Tejpreet, you know, because she has like, you see her, she starts off being like really quiet and then like this strong, defiant side of her comes out. And like she is actually the hero of the film. And so the women like really applauded. Overall, people have been very moved and it's been such a great experience. I'm not Sikh myself, but it's been great because I've been asked a lot of questions about the Sikh community and I've been able to direct people to different resources on the web that they could access and know more about the community. So,
Arpita, what was your first 4th of July like?
It was in New York City, and I spent it with, again, I love this about America because everybody's identity is hyphenated. So I spent it with a friend who is Tibetan American. So I didn't even know that we were going to go see fireworks. So I was talking to her, and suddenly she turns me around because my back was towards the fireworks. And I see the whole sky explode into these amazing fireworks, and it just blew my mind. And in India, we have Diwali, which is a Hindu festival of lights, where we have fireworks. And I was just like, oh my God, this is just like Diwali. So for the next 2 years, I wished everyone happy Diwali on 4th of July, because for me, it was like, you know, our Diwali. But I think it was one of my favorite memories here.
Arpita Kumar directed the short film My Dear Americans. Thank you, Arpita.
Thank you so much.
For many of us on the East Coast, it's been a wet and windy July 4th. Hurricane Arthur has brought powerful gusts and drenching rains as it travels up the eastern seaboard. Storm watchers have been posting images of Hurricane Arthur as it moves north state by state. But one of our producers here spotted some incredible images of Arthur from space. My colleague Andrea Crossan is with me in the studio. And Andrea, what have you been looking at?
Hey, Carol. So I'm going to be honest and say that I have been completely nerding out today. I've been looking at images of Arthur from space, and it's because I discovered that some of the crew members aboard the International Space Station have been tweeting photos. Now, the space station's orbit is right on course to pass over the storm, so astronauts have been watching from space as it's developed, and they've been tweeting what they've been seeing.
And obviously, a storm from space is very different from a storm on the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing about a hurricane is from the ground, what we see, it's going to be the destruction from the wind and from the rain. But from space, you can see the beauty in this incredible force of nature. So if you want to nerd out with me, you need to follow American astronaut Reid Weissman. His Twitter handle is astro_Reid, and he's been tweeting images since July 2nd, when Arthur was still just a tropical storm over the coast of Florida.
Yeah, I see an image he tweeted that day on July 2nd saying, "Just flew over tropical storm Arthur, hoping it heads out to sea. Looks mean."
Yeah, and yesterday, Reid tweeted a picture that clearly shows the eye of the hurricane.
Yeah, the photo's amazing. You actually see that little eye, which is sort of a break in this otherwise thick, white cloud. And he's also not the only astronaut you've been Twitter stalking.
No, I have to come clean, Carol, that I've also been Twitter stalking German astronaut Alexander Gierst. He's a member of the European Space Agency, and his Twitter handle, if you want to follow him, is astro_Alex. He's been sharing images of the hurricane, including one of it just before it hit landfall this morning off North Carolina. I did reach out to NASA and also to the European Space Agency to see if I could speak to Alex or to Reid today and talk about their photos. But that was a no-go. It turns out it would be easier to grow wings and fly up to the space station than it would be to make a phone call and chat with an astronaut. But the good news is that the crew aboard the space station has Independence Day off. So hopefully Reid and Alex will use some of their free time today to post more pictures. Also, if you want to see them, you can see the space station. There's a NASA website where if you put in your city and your state, it tells you when the space station is going to be passing overhead.
That's cool. Well, we have a link to that website, and you can see all of the pictures that Andrea has been collecting. They're all up on PRI.org. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you, Carol.
I'm Carol Hills. Ahead, a kid from El Salvador finds out the hard way why she needs to learn English.
We were playing Foursquare, and I had never played Foursquare. So all these kids are yelling at me and pointing to me to stand in the square. They pass me the ball. I hold on to the ball. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. And this girl just comes up and punches me right in the nose.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic, celebrating people living with medical technology who are giving back to their communities. Apply for the Bakken Invitation Award and earn a $20,000 charitable grant for your charity. Learn more at liveongiveon.org.
I'm Carol Hills in for Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. It's July 4th, so of course we're going to spend the next part of the show talking about France. When you think about America's struggle for independence, you probably don't think about the French, but there might not have been a United States, independent of Great Britain, were it not for the French. We're going to talk now about one Frenchman who was critical in that effort, and here to help us is François Furstenberg, historian at Johns Hopkins University. He's author of the book When the United States Spoke French, which comes out later this month. So, François, who is this guy, Louis-Marie Vicomte de Noailles?
Well, he was the descendant of one of France's noblest families. They had been serving the King of France for centuries. The family had traditionally been soldiers and served in the army. And Noailles was Lafayette's brother-in-law, I mean the Noailles who we're concerned with.
How critical was his role in the American Revolution?
Well, he played an important role. He led the siege of Savannah in 1779. He returned to France shortly thereafter, and then he sailed over with the Comte de Rochambeau, who led the French forces in North America in 1780. And they made their way to Yorktown. And Yorktown, which ended the revolution in North America, continued for a few more years in other places. But the war ended in Yorktown thanks essentially to the French forces. I mean, it was the French Navy that blocked the Chesapeake, that prevented the British Navy from supplying Yorktown. It was French military engineers that largely led the siege of the fort at Yorktown, which led to the British defeat, the almost inevitable British defeat at that point.
And didn't George Washington entrust Noailles with the details of the surrender?
Well, it was Noailles. Noailles represented the French government at Yorktown. And there's a famous scene where the British commander of Yorktown tries to surrender his arms to the French, and it would have been to Noailles, therefore. And Noailles refused, and therefore the kind of humiliating gesture where the British commander was forced to surrender his arms to the Americans, to Washington.
So this guy, Louis-Marie Vicomte de Noailles, he's a kind of well-bred, educated member of French nobility, knows all the movers and shakers, big in the French Revolution. So he ends up in Philadelphia. Why did he end up there?
Well, after the revolution, he went back to France, and he was among the leaders of the French Revolution. But over the next couple of years, as the French Revolution became more radical, he was more or less chased out of France. He fled. And so he came to the United States in 1793, and he settled in Philadelphia, which was the capital of the United States at the time. This was before Washington, D.C. had been built. And he settled in Philadelphia, where he was joined by waves of French refugees.
And what's the significance of his presence and time in Philadelphia?
When we think about these French characters who were living in Philadelphia at the time, we have a really, I think, a different portrait of the early republic. This is a time when the United States was deeply enmeshed in transatlantic commerce, transatlantic politics, and diplomacy. We see a capital city that's populated not just by people like Washington and Hamilton and Jefferson, but by thousands of Frenchmen who are fleeing war and violence across the Atlantic world and who are taking refuge in the United States. They're bringing new goods, new commerce into the capital, and they're really making the United States capital into a much more cosmopolitan city than we tend to think about.
What kind of things were they bringing to Philly that weren't there before they got there?
Well, after the American Revolution, American trade had been in large part reoriented into the French imperial networks. So there are things like wine is coming in, mustards are coming in, silk. France was dominated the luxury trades, really. So all kinds of very refined goods. And when these Frenchmen come in from France, I mean, Noailles had been Marie Antoinette's dance partner. He was one of the most famous dancers in the court of Versailles. And so people like him, they give dance lessons to Philadelphia's elite. They give French language lessons to Philadelphians. They bring in all kinds of goods and services that hadn't been. A hairdresser who trained with Marie Antoinette's hairdresser came to Philadelphia and hawked her goods and services. A French dentist made George Washington's false teeth.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, one thinks about the Philadelphia, in a slightly different way.
Well, one thinks about the American government's and the Americans' attitudes toward France in a very different way, too.
That's right.
It's not as like we've been sort of buddies for many years now.
I was thinking about this a lot during the run-up to the Iraq War when there was all this anti-French sentiment in the United States, and Americans were saying that France was so ungrateful for American intervention in World War II, which, of course, liberated France from Germany. But, I mean, from a longer perspective, of course, it's France that the United States owes, in a sense, France a debt of gratitude for liberating it from the British Empire. And this was something that was remembered. I mean, if we forget it today, it was certainly not forgotten in the 19th century. People looked towards France as the first American ally. Lafayette was remembered overwhelmingly in the 19th century. He was venerated almost on par with George Washington as his sort of adopted son. And when America intervened in World War I, when Americans sent troops to Europe in World War I, they thought of themselves as repaying Lafayette's debt. So so this is a long memory that Americans have that they've only sort of recently, I think, forgotten.
Historian François Furstenberg is the author of the upcoming book, When the United States Spoke French. Happy 4th of July.
Thank you very much, you too.
These days, we still look forward to French imports. In fact, just outside of Boston, there's a little French gourmet shop that's pulling in American and French customers. It's in Lexington, of Lexington and Concord fame, and it sells the kind of French delicacies that you'd expect. But reporter Adeline Sear found that it offers something else that French expats like her yearn for.
When François and Cécile Attard opened their shop, Ma France, outside Boston last year, they hardly spoke any English. They've been working on that.
We come from the southwest, near Bordeaux, the Périgord, exactly.
That's François Attard. He'd been hearing from friends in Boston about how difficult it was to find good European foods there, so he saw a business opportunity. It took him 2 years to persuade his wife Cécile to sell her hair salon in Périgueux. You see, François was eager for a career change.
Me, I was policeman. I worked for 5 years in the secret services in motorbike.
From their home region of Périgord, the couple now sells duck liver pâté and goat cheeses. They also have all kinds of sausages delivered monthly. Then there are the pastries, silky chocolate, vanilla, and coffee eclairs, colorful macaroons, creamy Napoleons, and chocolate raspberry fondant. Fresh products, especially the croissant and fresh sausages, sell out quickly, so the Attards encourage customers to reserve them ahead of time. But cheese may be the biggest draw here. There's Époisses, a creamy, strong-smelling cheese doused and ripened with cognac. Also, Bêtemal, a goat's milk cheese, and sheep's milk camembert.
It's a mix with the sheep and the goat milk.
Customer Eric Oldsman is tasting some of the new arrivals.
Oh, that's good. That's delicious. This one, too.
One piece?
Yeah, please.
He went for a semi-soft cheese from the Basque country.
Yeah, this is a fantastic addition to the community because it's very hard to get like good cheeses, and they have this fantastic collection. So I come here maybe once every 2 weeks for the cheeses and also some of the meats. And the breads are also very good.
I come from Burgundy in France, a region rich with wines and cheeses. So when I first walked into the shop, I wasn't surprised to find those gourmet items. But then I noticed some things that you usually can't find on this side of the Atlantic. The kind that spurred instant flashbacks. French junk food. Packages of classic chocolate-covered cookies, jelly cookies, neon red strawberry marshmallow candy, a peanut-flavored puffed snack, carambars, the French version of Tootsie Rolls, and a chocolate breakfast cereal. Maybe bad for your health, but good for my French expat soul. Shop co-owner Cécile Attard says they did a little crowdsourcing to figure out what customers wanted.
On a commencé donc avec les fromages et après nous avons développé le rayon épicerie.
We began with cheeses, says Cécile, and then we developed the grocery store section with the help of a notebook where customers could write down what they'd like to see here and what they were bringing back from France in their suitcases. Many would bring back preserves and things like cake mixes and baking powder, even croutons, which are now sold at this store. The goods here are truly a reflection of what a whole generation of French people grew up with. Catherine Chollet is a regular. She says walking into the shop transported her.
It was lovely. It was a little bit of slice of home here in Lexington, which I like.
Her personal vice? Orange jelly cookies.
The Chamonix Orange, this is something that I used to love when I was a child. Soft orange jelly with an orange coating on top. They're delicious.
As for me, I was thrilled to find bottles of mint or fruit syrup that you mix with water. This syrup used to be a staple of my afternoon snack as a child. One cooling sip of the mint syrup evokes powerful memories of summers in France. I've been known to bring back those heavy bottles in my luggage. And the good news is, I don't have to do that anymore. For The World, this is Adeline Sear, Lexington, Massachusetts.
Want to see what French junk food looks like? We've got pictures of some of Adeline's favorites at PRI.org. And since we're talking about all things French, the Tour de France gets underway this weekend, but not in France. This year, cycling's biggest race starts in Britain, in Yorkshire. For cycling fans, this isn't a big surprise. It's the 20th time the organizers have started the race outside of France. The idea is to give other people a chance to see the Tour race through their streets. And our colleague at the BBC, Matthew Slater, says people in Yorkshire are going all out.
Yorkshire has embraced this race, has engaged with this race in a way that I've never seen before. I've seen quite a few tours now, and I know I'm a little bit biased, but Yorkshire has grasped the spirit of the Tour. There isn't an abandoned bicycle anywhere in Yorkshire anymore. They've all been spray-painted yellow and nailed to the sides of buildings. There's bunting everywhere. Every village, school, business has put on some sort of show, some sort of land art, some sort of way of marking the Tour's visit here. It is absolutely breathtaking.
I've heard there's even some painted sheep.
Oh, painted sheep, painted alpacas. People have been building kind of replica Eiffel Towers in their back gardens. Squares have been turned into French market gardens. It's just the most incredible response, really, to this race. And it's getting a great reaction from the riders. It's getting an amazing reaction from the organisers of the Tour. Foreign broadcasters love it. So this is very much about Yorkshire putting its best foot forward.
I read that a butcher actually created a bicycle out of pork meat, which I thought was pretty incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've had things like schools spending presumably days, weeks when they could have been learning stuff to create sort of incredible kind of moving human bicycle images. There's been land art painted all over the sides of hills. Oh, it just, you name it. I mean, it's just been such a pleasure and a joy, really. Certainly as a journalist, there have been stories everywhere. It's been so easy to cover this event.
So it sounds like Yorkshire has a lot of just native pride and that's really expressing itself over this Tour de France.
Well, I think that's exactly it. I mean, Yorkshire's quite an unusual place in the UK. It's probably a bit like Texas in US terms. I mean, it's the biggest county, you know, our county, our states are called counties. It's very proud of itself. It often refers to itself as God's own county.
God's own county. Hmm.
The rest of the country sometimes thinks they're kind of maybe sort of blowhards a bit, you know, they're a lot of bluster. But there's a lot of natural beauty here. There's a lot of integrity, a lot of grit. Yorkshire people are sort of famously kind of gritty. There's a lot of kind of natural, earthy humour here. And there is enormous regional pride. There's no doubt about it. There is enormous regional pride here. So it's a really, really good partner for something like the Tour de France.
And I know that a former British champion, Sir Bradley Wiggins, is not in the race. So I'm curious who the Brits are going to be cheering for.
Well, that has been one of the stories, I guess, of build-up. Sir Bradley Wiggins was the first Brit to win this race. He won in 2012. He was already a very famous man. He'd won lots of Olympic medals. And immediately after winning the Tour, 1 week later, he won a gold medal in London. He also opened the Olympic ceremony. And at the end of that year, was knighted. So he is pretty much not just the most famous cyclist we've got, he's one of the most famous sports people we've got. Now, he has a bit of an issue at his team. There's a bit of a personality clash. And he's slightly unfortunate in that the following year, i.e. last year, the second Brit ever to win it won it, Chris Froome. So his team has two great champions. And cycling is a team sport, and they don't quite work together. They're dynamic in the team. So Froome has been picked, and Wiggins hasn't. Now, Froome is less famous. He's perhaps less popular, I guess, than Wiggins. So, you know, it's been an interesting selection. I think the public will still get behind Froome. We love a Brit. We love a winner. And there's another great British rider here called Mark Cavendish. He's got a very good chance of winning the first stage on Saturday. So we've got Brits that we can cheer for.
Matthew Slater is the BBC's Tour de France correspondent. We've been talking to him from Yorkshire. Thanks so much, Matthew.
No problem at all. Cheers, then. Bye.
For many Americans, July 4th is a day to take another look at our nation's founding document. And here's a shocker. There might be a typo in the version of the Declaration of Independence that we're all familiar with. And one expert says it's about time we fixed it.
There's no question of amending the Declaration. It's merely a matter of correcting an error in the transcription. And when I say transcription, what that means is an effort to render in print what's on the parchment that everybody signed starting on August 2nd, 1776.
Danielle Allen is a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. She says that when the original Declaration of Independence started to fade and copies were made, someone put a period where it shouldn't have been. The period sits at the end of the phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Allen says here's the problem. The period breaks up the most important sentence about American ideals ever written. It should have highlighted the importance of good government, not just individualism.
It moves from the individual to the collective, from me to we, from our individual rights to what we need to do together, build good instruments of government to secure our collective safety and happiness. And it's that arc from the individual to the collective that's so important in the sentence. And that's what gets broken off right in the middle, right after the introduction of the individual, when you put a period after pursuit of happiness.
Stay tuned. The National Archives says it's looking at ways to re-examine the original Declaration of Independence, which has faded to the point of being almost unreadable. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. President Obama used the 4th of July holiday to swear in some new U.S. citizens. The president stood beside more than two dozen immigrants, including some members of the U.S. military, who took the pledge at a White House ceremony today. Obama said welcoming immigrants to America's shores is central to our way of life and part of our DNA, but that America's policies toward immigrants need to be retooled.
If we want to keep attracting the best and the brightest from beyond our shores, we're going to have to fix our immigration system, which is broken, and pass common sense immigration reform. We shouldn't be making it harder for the best and the brightest to come here and create jobs here and grow our economy here. We should be making it easier.
The president's comments come at a time when tens of thousands of kids from Central America have been streaming across the U.S.-Mexico border. It's not the first time the U.S. has seen a wave of Central American migrants running from violence. Susan Cruz was just 8 years old when she and her mother left El Salvador for the U.S. It was 1978, and the first rumblings of El Salvador's civil war had just begun. Cruz's mother had been working with a fledgling rebel movement. Salvadoran authorities arrested her and expelled her from the country. She and her young daughter made their way to Los Angeles. As part of our First Days series, Susan Cruz looks back on her initial memories of America.
When we arrived in Los Angeles, we literally just had one piece of luggage each, my mother and I. And we landed, and all I remember was looking at my mother's face for a sense of understanding what was going on. I remember my mother having a very distraught look on her face, and it felt like there was something very unexpected about to come, and naturally that made me anxious as well, not knowing what was going to happen next. Even though I had grown up in El Salvador looking at the newspapers that arrived to our home every day, there would be full-blown color photographs of dead bodies. There would be pictures inside the newspaper where someone's head was placed on top of a stick on the side of the road. While it did seem scary, it just seemed that that's just the way things were. I remember that even before we arrived, the big thing in the movies was Saturday Night Fever. So I remember those songs very well, and it's interesting now. When you think of a song like Staying Alive by the Bee Gees that came out in Saturday Night Fever, really, we left our country to stay alive. I think in the very beginning, my mom and I held to each other as best as we could, although considering my mother, you know, had been tortured while she had been detained, and I didn't understand her emotional distancing sometimes. There was a time where I often wondered, you know, what could I do to make it better? Whenever she would cry at night, or if she received news from El Salvador and it was about the death of a family member. A lot of our family was killed during the war. And I didn't understand things like survivor's guilt and how my mother was probably feeling that. So I think in the beginning as a child, I really tried very hard to just stick as close by and just have my presence there. And also because I needed her. I was a child. I depended on her. I had nobody else. I think the most important thing as a child was not being able to understand the language. There was this one incident where we were playing Foursquare, and I had never played Foursquare. So all these kids are yelling at me and pointing to me to stand in the square. So I stand in the square. They pass me the ball. I hold on to the ball. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it. The kids are yelling at me. I don't understand them. And this girl just comes up and punches me right in the nose. And as I see blood now in my hand coming out of my nose, I react and I fight back. So the two of us get sent to the principal's office. And at the principal's office, I cannot explain to the principal, who doesn't speak Spanish,
and I can't speak English. The result of that was that I was suspended, sent home, and of course got punished by my mom the way that kids get punished in El Salvador with a belt. And so I quickly realized, wow, I really need to learn English quickly. Otherwise, this is just going to be a problem that I'm going to face every day. And one of our very few recreational activities, you know, that we did have, we would go to this movie theater on Vermont Avenue in Santa Monica. It's an old movie theater called the Campus Theater. And they would show movies for very low cost, particularly the matinees. But it was interesting because they would also show Mexican movies. And for me, that was something that was like an oasis in the middle of all this culture clash and a feeling of isolation. We would go to the Campus Theater and we would see these Mexican movies with Pedro Infante. And they were in Spanish, so I could understand. Albeit some of them were very inappropriate, in my opinion, now for children. But the fact that they spoke Spanish and that I could identify with that made me realize that I wasn't all alone. There was also, at that time, Grease had just come out. We take the pressure and we throw away. Conventionality belongs to yesterday. And in my attempt to try to cheer up my mother, I convinced her to dress up like Olivia Newton-John. And I would try, you know, to mimic the song, you know, the last song that they play in the movie. Meditate my direction. Feel your way. And my mother's older sister, she was dating this man who had a brother living in Los Angeles. When the brother met my mother, he was very impressed by her. And he would go look for her, try to ask her out. He even bought me a skateboard. It was my first, skateboard. I think he was trying really hard to impress my mother, but my mother was someplace else emotionally and psychologically. And as crazy as it sounds, I remember seeing Grease, and in my 8-year-old self, I thought I was going to play matchmaker. So I was trying to convince my mom to dress up like Olivia Newton-John. She complied to some degree. She wore the black blouse and the black pants. And, you know, she tried to do her hair and some makeup. And I thought, you know, that would make her feel better, that it would also help her try, you know, to connect with other people, and that perhaps what I couldn't do to help her, perhaps somebody else could. By the way, it did work to some degree, because she ended up marrying him and they ended up having a child, my younger brother. Amorcito corazón, yo tengo
tentación de un beso. Music was a lifeline for Susan Cruz when she arrived in the U.S. So for all you new Americans out there, what got you through your first days here? Let us know. Visit PRI.org/firstdays. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Just use the hashtag firstdays. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great holiday.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation, by the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor, the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Linda Larson and Jerry Johnson, the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Noor Hall. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.